This is the Takeaway Podcast for Monday, May 16th, 2016.
This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. South America is boiling. The suspension of Brazil's president by a Brazilian legislature, where more than half of the lawmakers are in legal trouble of some kind, from bribery to kidnapping and murder. One of the lawmakers goes by the name of Grumpy. That government is crumbling as the economy in Brazil is contracting at a rate of 3.8%. Joblessness is at 10% and rising. There's the Zika virus and the Olympics looming later on this year. Meanwhile, to the north, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has declared a nationwide state of emergency, where a deep economic crisis has the country headed for total political collapse, according to observers inside and outside of Caracas. President Maduro has said he will seize closed factories and arrest employees. He's blamed the nation's troubles on the United States, all moves of desperation to show leadership amidst the country's opposition movement, calling for a referendum on Maduro's term. Ricardo Hausman is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's director of the Harvard Center for International Development. Professor Hausman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So Venezuela's problems are political or economic?
Venezuela's problems are the consequence of the craziest economic policy ever in the country or in the world. It's a country that has gone through its longest and highest oil boom in its history and ended up that period over-indebted with a destroyed productive capacity, and now it cannot face the reduction in the price of oil. It has no access to international financial markets to borrow. It has no reserves left. It has a crazy system of controls that has led to rationing and shortages and long lines. And it has a collapsing healthcare system where fundamental drugs are not being imported because the country ran out of foreign exchange. And so the country is living now its worst year from an economic and a social point of view, and a humanitarian crisis that is being hidden away by lack of information.
Is this the legacy of Hugo Chavez, or is this Maduro's responsibility? He was the person who was going to try to transition away from Chavez's connection with the poor, using the oil money to essentially buy them off and become a national hero.
Well, this is the consequence of Hugo Chavez. Hugo Chavez, in his last year in government, had the price of oil at 104, but he spent as if the price of oil was at 197. And he borrowed the difference. And when Maduro came in, the market said, you know, Chavez has borrowed so much money that you are no longer eligible for more loans. So that caused him to lose international finance. So he started printing money.
Would you say that the opposition has an alternative plan if they were to vote Maduro out of office?
I think yes. I think that essentially it's very clear the direction in which the country would have to go. It would have to reestablish, you know, basic market mechanisms, basic balances, but it would need massive international support. And the government of Maduro doesn't want to hear anything of international support other than from China or maybe Belarus. But we are too big, they are too small relative to the needs of the crisis.
But the nation and many people in South America recall austerity strategies in the past as being related to dictatorship and to coercive economic policies that come from, you know, El Norte, from the United States, from maybe even like the University of Chicago Business School. How do you adopt those kinds of austerity policies without recalling the fears of the past?
Well, I don't know. The 90s was a period of democracy and austerity. It's not so much a question of ideology as it is a question of commodity prices. When commodity prices are high, everybody looks like a genius. When commodity prices are low, you need austerity to bring spending in line with what your revenues are. But, you know, the democratic governments of Fernando Enrique Cardoso, Carlos Menem, elsewhere in Mexico and Colombia and Peru and so on, were able not only to stabilize the situation, bring inflation down, but also get reelected with a massive majority. So I don't buy the association between either austerity and lack of democracy. Right now, we have the worst of all possible things. We have a complete craziness and lack of balance mixed with the most authoritarian regime Venezuela has ever had.
Ricardo Hausmann is professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and director of the Harvard Center for International Development. Ricardo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In this 2016 election, the Affordable Care Act is very much in play in the courts. A federal judge last week ruled that the act's implementation violates the Constitution, the same judge that just a year ago allowed Congress to sue the president over Obamacare. The act is also in play in the rhetoric of the candidates. Donald Trump.
We're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. Obamacare is a total and complete disaster. It's going to be gone.
And Hillary Clinton.
We finally have a path to universal health care. We've accomplished so much already. I do not want to see the Republicans repeal it, and I don't want to see us start over again with a contentious debate.
That is a huge divergence. Obamacare's repeal and the Affordable Care Act becoming a single-payer universal health care system on the Democratic side. Julie Rovner, a senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, is this rhetoric and courtroom uncertainty just tearing the ACA apart?
This is now the third presidential election where the ACA has been sort of a major point of contention. And I think one of the problems is that I won't necessarily say it is here to stay, but it's certainly here. And taking it apart would be very difficult. But the other thing that's going on is that the candidates keep debating about the Affordable Care Act, and they're leaving aside a whole lot of other important health issues that simply aren't getting, you know, any oxygen because everybody's still fighting about the fate of the Affordable Care Act.
So what do you think that is going on that people should be focused on regarding the actual implementation of the act and the actual 20 million people who now have insurance?
What we're finding is that a lot of people, even with insurance, still can't afford their health care. And this is not really the law's fault, although in some ways you could point to parts of the law that, you know, made this possible. Insurance companies discovered, okay, we have to enroll sick people too, so therefore we're going to make people pay higher portions of their medical bills. So it's not just the premiums, it's rising deductibles that are now often many thousands of dollars before insurance kicks in. It's rising co-insurance and co-pays. Employer insurance is doing the same thing. One of the interesting things we've seen with the law is that employers have mostly continued to offer insurance. A lot of people thought many employers would say, you can buy insurance on your own. You can get a subsidy if you have, you know, low or moderate income. We're just going to let you do that. But no, employers have mostly kept their health plans. But because health costs keep going up, employers have cut back on the generosity of those plans. So most people still get their insurance through their employers. On the other hand, people both, you know, with employer insurance and with their own insurance are finding that care itself is increasingly expensive.
Is the market providing incentives to companies to raise these rates? Is the Affordable Care Act forcing them to do this? Or are they taking advantage of the law or the current market conditions?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. One of the things that we've seen in the Affordable Care Act markets themselves, this is the individual market where people who don't have employer insurance buy their own coverage. Those markets are smaller and sicker than people had expected. And there's a lot of reasons why. One of them, as I mentioned, employers are continuing to offer insurance. So those people aren't going into the market. There was all this big clatter about people being able to keep their insurance. People who had their own individual insurance, they've been able to keep those policies much longer. Those were, by and large, healthy people because insurance companies didn't used to sell to sick people. So you've got a smaller and sicker pool in those individual market plans, and a lot of insurance companies underpriced. So now they're discovering that they have to, you know, raise premiums. And at the time, because they knew they had to cover a lot of different types of benefits that the law required, they did it by having, you know, fewer doctors available and fewer hospitals, what they call narrower networks, and also asking people to pay a larger share of their bills. And that's what we're seeing.
In the Republican rhetoric on repealing Obamacare, it sounds suspiciously like political revenge. There's not much detail to it. But as you look at the opposition plans, the Republican alternatives to Obamacare, is there something in those plans that would actually address some of the shortfalls in Obamacare that could be an argument for a new approach?
Well, the Republicans have had a really hard time coming up with a sort of unified alternative to the Affordable Care Act. They keep talking about repeal and replace, but, you know, at least the House Republicans have now been talking for 4 years about replacing without actually showing anything. Donald Trump put out a plan in March that was widely ridiculed by other Republicans. So the big problem for the Republicans is that the Affordable Care Act itself was based on a Republican idea. That's sort of the individual mandate requiring people to either have health insurance or pay a tax penalty. That was the first place to do that was Massachusetts under then Governor Mitt Romney. So the Republicans have a tough time coming up with an alternative because that was originally a Republican idea.
Is the Democratic path to universal payer or universal health care the extension of Medicare? And is that a viable approach? And will it reduce drug costs?
Well, that's certainly what Bernie Sanders has been talking about. He would like to see the U.S. do what they call a single payer or Medicare for all, you know, and is the country ready to go to single payer? Certainly the people who are voting for Sanders think it is. But Hillary Clinton, who has fought in more than one of these, you know, health overhaul wars, has said that she doesn't think the country is ready to go that far. Polls suggest she's probably correct, at least at this point.
Talking about a beleaguered status quo, the Affordable Care Act under siege during this 2016 campaign, but no real viable alternatives at this point. Julie Rovner, a senior correspondent with Kaiser Healthcare News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
About 6 months ago, I had a dream. And I dreamed that you were knocking at the door.
Later this hour, dreams that can go through prison walls.
I just started screaming. Just to see you standing there to that door with your tall self. I said, Lord, my son home. I cooked you everything you wanted. And you told me, you said, I'm home.
These voices come from radio producer Sylvia Ryerson, part of a long-running radio program at WMMT in Kentucky called Calls from Home. She has extended the reach of this radio program in a project called Restorative Radio, to deliver the recorded sounds of home into the cells of inmates.
On one hand, it's amazing that this tiny community radio station is able to provide this service, but you also have to ask, why is there such a need for people to be sending messages out on a public radio station? Why can't they afford phone calls? Why can't they afford to visit? Why is this one of their primary means of communication?
Michelle Hudson is a participant in the Restorative Radio Project and says for her fiancé, William, who was sentenced as a minor to a 60-year term, the weekly radio broadcasts have been a lifeline.
He said that he was filled with instant joy because these are sounds that he missed that were, they're so familiar but yet so far away. And he said he just closed his eyes and he listened to everybody and he could visualize our smiles or our facial expressions. And that's what these sounds do for him.
Sylvia Ryerson, Michelle Hudson, and the Restorative Radio Project later this hour. Do you have a recording of a friend or a loved one that shows the power of sound to reverse time and compress space?
My name is Maya, and I'm calling from Chicago. I have a voicemail from several years ago of my parents wishing me Happy New Year. It's one of the last voice messages I got from my dad before he got sick and passed away. I can't bring myself to delete it, even though I have the sound of it memorized.
Do you have special messages you've saved? Those sounds, call us with them at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. In Alabama, hundreds of prisoners have been on strike since May 1st at the Holman and Elmore facilities, a protest that has since expanded to at least three other facilities in the state. Overcrowding is an issue. Alabama's prison system is the most congested in the country and houses nearly twice as many prisoners as it's built to contain. Working conditions are also an issue, as well as unpaid prison labor, which, according to this inmate speaking from inside his cell in solitary confinement where he's been for 28 months, unpaid prison labor has another name.
These strikes are our methods for challenging mass incarceration. As we understand that the prison system is a continuation of the slave system, we understood that our incarceration was pretty much about our labor and the money that was being generated through the prison system. Therefore, we began organizing around our labor and used it as a means and a method in order to bring about reform in the Alabama prison system.
That's one of the inmate activists in Alabama, Kinetic Justice, speaking on the Democracy Now! Program. Joining me now is Pastor Kenneth Glasgow, director of the Ordinary People's Society, who's been negotiating with the Alabama Department of Corrections over the strikers' demands. Pastor, welcome.
Hey, how are you? And thank you for having us.
How effective can these inmates be as labor organizers facing the government?
Well, I'm going to be very honest with you. Really don't look at how effective they could be. Let's look at how effective all of us could be. But this is a $1.5 billion industry, okay? And what ends up happening there, right there at Elmore, where Kinetic Justice is at, is where they make all the license plates. If they stop work there, 100,000 license plates a week, then that puts them in a real bad deficit. One of the things that came out of this strike is the fact that guards, the correctional officers themselves, had to actually go in and start feeding in the kitchen, and they had to go start washing the clothes for them in the laundry. And rumors were that they was about to strike if they didn't do something about it. Now, how it affected also is those of us on the outside. So we asked their families, since they're on lockdown, since they can't go to commissary anyway, withdraw all your money that you're sitting in. The thing that people don't understand about the prison system nowadays is everything that the people get that's locked up in prison, they pay for. So you got an industry, besides the $1.5 billion they're making just off the industry, look how much they're making off the inmates themselves.
How is the state going to respond if they say they have no funds and you describe what seems to be an effective organization? Have you really shut off that spigot of $1.8 billion?
Well, when the inmates stop labor and you stop free labor and you stop $1.5 million from being produced, you are very effective. The more amplitude of it is that these people on the inside did something that we can't even do on the outside. They went beyond race. They went beyond religion. They went beyond any kind of obstacles to keep them from being together. And they united under strenuous conditions. You know, I did 14 years in prison. I know how hard and strenuous it is to try to organize people on the inside. But even more so than that, how hard is it to organize people when you're in solitary confinement, not even with the general population? So I think that they were very effective and they did it peacefully. One of the things that, people don't want to highlight is that Holman Prison, where Connecticut Justice was at, had just went through a riot. You had officers that were hurt. You had inmates that were hurt. They stopped that violence. See, this peaceful strike stopped the violence. That was the inmates did that, the officers.
What are your demands, and how do you think this could end?
Well, the demands are for the inmates in there. They want to deal with about 7 different things, and then we have 3. Those 7 different things that they ask for is the life without parole, because in Alabama, you could get 3 possession charges of marijuana and you get life without parole, okay? They want to address the drive-by shooting. The drive-by shooting, you could have like a guy who has road rage. He gets in trouble, he goes to prison, this and that and the other. But if you do a drive-by shooting, they say it's gang activity, which is mostly black folks, let's be honest, then you get a life without a parole sentence again. In the Alabama Prison Reform Act, we have addressed the parole board for the first time in history. The parole board in Alabama is given the explanation and detailing why they denied somebody parole. They wanted to address also, the rehabilitation, the reentry, and the education inside. And those are things that the commissioner even told me that he will be willing to do. And of course, they want to end the free slave trade, working for 17 cents an hour. Those are the main things that they ask for in their demands. The things that we ask for in our demands is that they allow us to come in, see those inmates. I ask them emphatically when I talk to them on Friday, and that we need a fact-finding commission. That fact-finding commission will go in, talk to the inmates, see the deplorable conditions of the prisons and all, and then we will come out and try to help with some solutions and some resolution toward these problems. The other thing is very, very important, and that's the Open Records Act. In Alabama prisons, there is no grievance procedure. So how can we have transparency or accountability if you can't even write up officers who are doing wrong? This is one of the major reasons why they had the peaceful strike.
Pastor Kenneth Glasgow, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pastor Kenneth Glasgow is director of the Ordinary People's Society. He's been negotiating with Alabama's Department of Corrections during this strike. LSD is a controlled substance. and, to some, a doorway to another dimension.
We were somewhere around Barstow when the drugs began to take hold.
Think for yourself. Question authority.
What happens during these blackout periods is you get the feeling of phenomenal acceleration, like you're being shot out over millions, billions of years. Time simply obliterates.
Today, a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. Here's Tom with the weather.
Our friends at the Retro Report decided to explore this pharmacological mystery and target of the war on drugs in a new documentary on the emerging use of psychedelic drugs to treat things like addiction. Retro Report producer Joshua Fisher says LSD represents a piece of scientific and cultural history.
In the 1950s, it was actually considered almost a wonder drug. People were really excited about the potential for this drug in a whole range of areas. At first, they thought it might help people figure out what was going on with schizophrenia or other mental illnesses. Then they started to use it in therapy. But as the 60s progressed and you had people like Kesey and Leary and the Grateful Dead, and it became more of a street drug used with less caution, with less regulation, bad trips happened and people began to fear it.
Freaking help me.
And as you say, there was a West Coast component to that. Here's Governor Ronald Reagan.
There is nothing smart. There is nothing grown up or sophisticated in taking an LSD trip at all. They're just being complete fools.
In our time, LSD has once again made its way back into medical research. What's that journey been?
Well, this is really a picking up of where the science was left off in 1970 when it became a Schedule I drug. Schedule I means it's no accepted medical use. And so at that point, it was very difficult to do scientific research on the drug. But after 30, 40 years, all that kind of cultural baggage has started to slip away, and a few researchers are looking at what they did in the 50s and early 60s and following up on that.
Tell me about Sherry Marcy.
Sherry Marcy is a woman, lives in Ann Arbor. In 2010, she learned she had cancer, pretty serious stage 3 cancer, started treatment, radiation chemotherapy. But part of that was she became very depressed, and she happened to read an article in the New York Times about one of the studies that were going on with psilocybin, which is a drug related to LSD, looking at depression and anxiety in cancer patients, and became a part of the study.
The turn on doesn't have to be emphasized at all. The dropout is an absolute mistake, but the tune in is crucial. Tune into the world, to me, to things I used to love, to my relationships, to my family. Tune in is what it's all about.
She, of course, is referring to the famous turn on, tune in, drop out nomenclature, and emphasizing the tune in that healed her of depression. Is that clinically established?
I don't know if we can say clinically healed her of depression, but what it did was it allowed her to kind of reset her mental state and kind of refocus on the things that were important to her. So the way it worked is there was a lot of screening involved and some therapy as well. This is really nowadays the model is you use a psychedelic experience alongside therapy. She took psilocybin twice. And in that experience in which she was carefully monitored and guided, she said it's like kind of a veil had been lifted. She was able to open her eyes and look around and see her life for what it was and all the things that she had been interested in that were important to her and kind of reconnect with those again. So her spouse, her kids, and it lasted. She kind of got out of the kind of cancer depression that she had.
And is this the future of psychedelics, this kind of therapy and this sort of experimentation? Is this the future of psychedelics?
Well, I believe this is, you know, it's still very early in the research. There's a lot more that has to be done. And LSD and psilocybin are still Schedule I drugs. They're very much illegal still. The scientists this time are being very careful not to kind of go down the road that folks like Timothy Leary did. So they're very cautious about it. They're hopeful that the research will continue, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
No more merry pranksters.
No more merry pranksters, at least among the scientific set.
Joshua Fisher is a producer at Retro Report. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you.
We interrupt this digital screen period in the history of civilization to remind you all of a little thing that once ruled the world for centuries. Just a little thing called
paper.
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 Always stay gracious. Best revenge is your paper.
Paper.
The holder of text and graphics and images of Beyoncé in happier times. Paper. The tough, ephemeral substance that allows you to do this because of this.
A continuously running series of manufacturing processes that will convert the pulp solution into the perfect paper grade for each market application.
Paper is the product of a very high-tech set of processes, you know, that would test the techie jargon of anyone in Silicon Valley. This guy, you might say, is from Cellulose Valley.
With the help of module jet dilution technology, the CD basis weight profile is controlled precisely in sections, thereby achieving constant and excellent basis weight profiles.
Whoa, did you know this machine also uses Nipkaflex shoe press technology? Right, and all you were looking for was a simple post-it note. Well, there's nothing simple about paper, which is why it has attracted the attention of the one-word book title master himself, Mark Kurlansky. He told you all about salt and cod. His new book is called Paper. The subtitle, Paging Through History, I guess, was added because they needed to fill up the paper. Mark Kurlansky would say paper still rules for a while, and its story is our story. Mark Kurlansky, welcome to The Takeaway.
Nice to be here, Jack.
This is such a great story. I mean, you know, it's so much more than Gutenberg and, you know, figuring out how to dry pulp and papyrus and all that sort of thing. Where do you love starting this story? I mean, we can go on for hours.
I was drawn to it because it was a great story. But I realized that you really have to start with written communication. Probably that huge underestimated moment in history when society shifted from oral communication to written communication. And once that happened, which a lot of people were upset about.
Plato was upset about it.
Plato was upset about it, but also did it. He was kind of like the people nowadays who write books on computers, denouncing computers. But once that happened, then it became about finding the best stuff to write on.
The Chinese are particularly obsessed with the quality of paper, different kinds of paper, paper used for things way beyond writing. And the writing that the Chinese do on paper is beyond language. Calligraphy is a direct result of the beauty of letters on paper.
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese have a very unusual language, which hundreds of thousands of characters and a tremendous importance has always been attached to your ability to write it in brush strokes in the right order. And, you know, in Chinese homes and in buildings, you see calligraphy hanging as artwork. And paper, which the Chinese invented, greatly facilitated this whole art form of writing.
How did a Frenchman determine that wasps had a better way of making paper than the Chinese, and why did that languish for a century?
Graimur noticed that wasps build their nests by eating into wood and creating these very thin walls, which were in fact paper. And he said, you know, why don't we do this? Because up until then, paper was largely made from rags. The Asians used a bit of tree bark sometimes, but had a rag component, and most Europe and America was all rags.
And rags were a commodity. I mean, it was a commodity trade. Rag prices in the U.S. were insane.
It was extremely – the U.S. imported rags. It was extremely difficult as, you know, the written word expanded and publishing expanded to get enough rags for the paper that people wanted. And there were numerous grisly incidents of – one at the Battle of Gettysburg, a number in the Napoleon Wars where papermakers would go out on the battlefield and strip the dead of their bandages and uniforms for rags to make paper.
In many cases to report the dead on that paper.
That's right.
Indeed. Why did the technology of paper get appropriated to change Christianity in the Reformation?
You know, this is an example. One of the things that I really learned from doing this book is that technology doesn't change society, that society changes and calls up the technology it needs to facilitate that change. So in the Reformation, they used a lot of paper. You know, Martin Luther posting those things on doorways and pamphlets and all the stuff that was circulated. And they needed paper for this, and printing was basically invented. It's not a coincidence that Western printing was invented in Germany. You know, this became the way to do political movements, paper, in the American Revolution, in the French Revolution, in the 1960s, all the way until social media. Paper was the way to have a political movement.
And, you know, in many ways, the technology of paper is the social media of its time. Mark Kurlansky, thanks so much.
Nice talking to you, John.
Do prisoners have to lose their families as part of their punishment for committing crimes? Although it may never be stated in the sentencing, defendants given long, perhaps lifelong sentences in supermax facilities far from the communities where they grew up, loss of family is a consequence of prison that may be the most painful part of the punishment. In many cases, repeat offenders may have already become estranged from family and loved ones, but why should the prison system enforce a punishment on innocent family members and deny defendants their only means of any emotional support?
Where are you calling tonight?
I'm calling from Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And my husband, he's actually in the federal penitentiary in Kentucky.
Hey, man. I'm just overwhelmed right now, man. I miss you, big dog. Keep your head up, man. All that. Love you, man.
Hi, this is a shout-out to Michael Dennis Austin at Red Onion State Prison. This is your mom. I'm calling to let you know that you're a new uncle.
You're the man that touches my heart. You're there to always listen and reassure me and protect me. And you're my love and my best friend.
This program on WMMT Radio is called Calls from Home. It's part of the Restorative Radio Project, which gives voice to families on the air, to inmates listening from deep inside two supermax prisons in Southwest Virginia. Radio producer Sylvia Ryerson has helped families connect through prison walls. Sylvia introduced us to Michelle Hudson, whose fiancé William is serving a 60-year sentence.
The prisons I worked with are in far Southwest Virginia, so a lot of the families live 6, 7, 8 hours away. So even just getting there for a visit is extremely difficult. The times they're allowed to visit are very strict and limited. Phone calls are very expensive. You know, letters are read by prison officials. So that's what's so beautiful about the medium of sound. It's something that can really permeate that barrier.
Hi, Devon. This is G-Ma, Grandma Essie. And I'm so blessed that we are on our way to church today, and your mother should be there. And after church, all of us will talk to you.
Tell me a little bit about Essie.
I first spoke to Essie in the studio at WMMT. She would call in every week to leave a message for her grandson, Devon, who's incarcerated at one of the supermax prisons the station reaches. And so for that piece, I met her at her home in Roanoke, Virginia, about 4 hours away, and just spent the entire day with her and her family. We went to church, and then we came home and had a fish fry with her entire extended family.
All right, Devon, guess what? We're back at home.
Great's in the process of making our rice and our peas, so I'm getting ready to go back here and drop this fish. So this is our chief cook in here.
I'm making 4 cheese rice, homeboy, and we're going to drop some fish.
And the idea was that Devon would listen to this and be in the picture.
That's right. Essie did an incredible job of, you know, narrating the journey and what was happening when, and sort of including him in the space.
And prison officials censored this, listened to it beforehand. What were the rules?
We followed all FCC regulations, and the prisoners are able to have MP3 players where they can tune into local radio stations. And so he was ready and listening.
You know, these are serious offenders. I mean, whatever you may think about supermax or solitary confinement, these are people who have made serious mistakes in their lives. How much is that a part of the conversation with families, and just in terms of how much them being in prison has changed the life of their loved ones on the outside?
I mean, I think once I got to know these families and heard more about the specifics of the cases of their loved ones, you realize it's much more complicated. Every single family I worked with was not able to afford a lawyer, facing extremely long sentences, extremely far from home, and really, in many cases, did not have a fair trial or court process. You know, once people go to prison, daily life goes on. And I think that's something that many of us don't have to grapple with.
So, Michelle, how did you decide to participate in this whole radio project?
I was contacted by Sylvia because I call into the Calls from Home show every Monday night, and I thought it would be wonderful considering the amount of time that William's been incarcerated.
How long is his sentence?
As of now, he still has 60 years left to serve.
And he's your fiancé.
And he's my fiancé.
It's almost like he's on the show if everyone's sending these messages to their loved ones, including you.
The show has become very important to a lot of families outside of just William. There are other men, and from what I hear, there are other women in the Appalachian area that listen to this radio station just to hear the stories or the love or just life in general, what's going on and you know, with work, kids, animals, you name it. I mean, we share just about everything on that radio station, and it gives everybody a little taste of home.
It's night-night time, bedtime, it's late. I would say it's Friday night, but it's probably about 1 a.m. So it's Saturday again, and I'm missing you. I can't stand this lockdown.
Now, he's not the only one hearing that, right? It's everybody on the radio station that's hearing it, right?
It's everybody that hears that.
And here's another recording, another example of how you've been able to break the prison wall down.
He's so silly. Come on, Troy.
Hey, Uncle, I love you. I wish we could spend time together and talk to each other. I love you very much.
Beautiful, Troy. Beautiful.
I went to his mother's house that weekend, and I asked whoever could possibly be there to just come there. I just wanted to record some sound. So his sister, Tanya, came over with her son, Troy. I just sat the recorder on the table, and we talked. We talked about him, things that he did growing up, and I just wanted to capture their voices and sounds that he doesn't typically get to hear every day, but that would bring back those memories.
What do you think the message is for America generally faced with an unsustainable incarceration situation nationally?
Oh, wow. I feel that what America should take away from this is that each individual person has a different story. And if they would take the time to get involved, I think they would find out that we have a system that really needs a lot of reform.
Prison reform, Sylvia?
Yeah. Dealing with the crisis of our prison system goes beyond just dealing with the institutions of prison, but it's about transforming the entire way our society operates and keeping people from being incarcerated in the first place.
So you think of yourself as part of the social network, really, in the sense that most of these people will be going back to society, and the more contact they have with their loved ones and their family members, the better prepared they will be.
Exactly. And that's sort of where the title of the project comes in, Restorative Radio, is this idea of restoring a sense of connection with your family, with your community that has been so decimated by the way our prison system operates. But through these messages, to help give people the strength to remember that when they do get out, they have a positive role to play when they come home.
Well, Sylvia Ryerson, producer of Restorative Radio, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
And Michelle Hudson, participant in the radio project, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
This is Anne Marie Cutler from Dresher. After my father passed away and my mother was going to change the answering machine, we saved a recording of his voice. I think that's one of the things you miss the most when you lose a loved one, is knowing that you'll no longer hear their voice.
Voices are life. They're also immortal. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Tell us a story of something you recorded. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway, our form of restorative radio.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.